Hello everyone, this is Frank Callahan broadcasting from the Audible Local Ledger, an affiliate station of the Massachusetts Radio Reading Service. I'll be reading this morning from today's paper, Monday, December 11, 2017. And we're reading from the Fall River Herald. Our first item this morning is headlined, Medical Pot Dispensary on the Way. Hope Heal Health to begin selling marijuana by spring. Our focus is Fall River. Eventually, we will expand, but right now, our focus is right here. That's a quote from Will Flanagan of Hope Heal Health and former Mayor Kevin P. O'Connor. Hope Heal Health will begin selling marijuana from its dispensary by the spring, the company owner said. By then, it will have grown and harvested its first crop and processed it into buds, brownies, lotions, and oils, said John Rogue, the company president. By then, it will have grown and harvested its first crop and processed it into buds, brownies, lotions, and oils, said John Rogue, the company president. We'll be open in the spring of 2018, he said. We will probably be the first to open in Fall River. Hope Heal Health is one of four companies to hold a license to dispense medical marijuana in the city. It is renovating two floors of a 172,000-square-foot brick mill building at 1 West Street, one of the Border City mill buildings. Rogue and Will Flanagan, the city's former mayor, outlined plans for the company this week. Flanagan is the company's legal representative and spokesman. As they spoke, construction workers built the framing inside the building to form the grow rooms, processing laboratories, and research and development laboratories that will be part of the operation. On the first floor of the mill, one story down, work is already underway on the dispensary. We will have a menu board on the wall with a counter in front of it for consultations, Flanagan said. We will have our people in the dispensary trained to help people get what they need. Hope Heal Health holds a license to dispense marijuana for medical purposes for people who hold a medical marijuana card. The company will produce 9 strains of cannabis to let patients and company consultants find a mix that will meet the customer's needs, Rogue said. Whatever the patient is trying to accomplish, we can help them with it, Flanagan said. The company will also prepare for the opening of the recreational market, expected in July 2018. State voters approved the legal recreational use of marijuana in a 2016 referendum. Before that happens, the company must build out its growing and processing facility to meet the state standards for pharmaceutical labs. It also must meet state and city standards for security, Flanagan said. New windows have already been installed on the 50,000 square feet of mill space the company will use immediately. All of the growing and processing rooms will be sealed and medically cleaned spaces. Workers going in and out will have to wear sterile coveralls and coverings over their heads, hands, and feet. The company will need up to 100 workers, Flanagan said. The jobs will include growers, bud tenders, retail consultants, kitchen staff, and security, he said. The average wage will be $45,000. The company is investing $8 million to $10 million in Fall River, Rogue added. It purchased the mill in December for $1.3 million. The mill was half filled by other tenants prior to the purchase. They remain in the building, Flanagan said. All of the company product, from the leaves to the lotions, will be produced to a biomedicinal standard, Rogue said. We face all the same regulations as a pharmaceutical company, he said. The company will make product only for its single dispensary, but it will have the capacity to wholesale goods once more dispensaries come online. Long term, we want to build this to a national brand, Flanagan said. We think that is possible. But for now, the company is keeping itself local, he said. This isn't easy to do, Flanagan said. There is a huge demand in the patient population here. We want to support that. Our focus is Fall River. Eventually, we will expand, but right now, our focus is right here. Here's a brief article from Westport. In 1989, the fire department had 22 full-time firefighters and responded to 1,390 emergency calls that year. This year, it has responded to more than 2,700 calls, but has 21 full-time firefighters. This is one reason why Fire Chief Brian Legendre is considering asking for an additional firefighter for fiscal 2019. Legendre recently met with selectmen to talk about this budget recommendation for the coming fiscal year, as well as ask for additional money from taxpayers this current year. Legendre said a fire lieutenant is expected to retire in April rather than August. With April falling into this fiscal year, Legendre is asking for approximately $33,000 in sick leave buyback. As a result, selectmen will likely place the item before the voters at the January 23rd special town meeting, which is being called to ask voters to authorize a bond to pay the town's share of a proposed grade 5 through 12 school building. Town Administrator Timothy King said there should be money available to cover the expense of the early retirement. Legendre's major budgetary concern surround staffing issues. Legendre told selectmen he would like 4 6-man shifts rather than 4 5-man shifts. Legendre said adding an additional full-time firefighter would help him realize that long-held departmental goal. It is basically the same plan I had in 2006, he said. Legendre said he relies on 10 call firefighters, but it is harder to recruit call firefighters due to the training involved to meet today's standards. Selectman Brian Valcourt noted the volume of calls and responsibilities have increased over the year for the fire department. That's a 97% increase with one less staffing over the last 28 years, Valcourt said, peering through documents highlighting the responsibilities that the department faces. That line of thinking prompted a question from Selectman R. Michael Sullivan. How can the department function with more calls and responsibilities and one fewer staff member? Legendre said he often uses overtime funds to cover emergencies or gaps in coverage. Sullivan noted that asking for an additional $64,000 in fiscal 2019 might be offset because the department would rely less on overtime costs. Selectman Chairman Stephen Ouellette asked Legendre to provide documentation that would highlight the cost benefits of hiring an additional firefighter and not delving into overtime costs. Next item is headline Off the Rails. Couple sues the city, says they weren't paid for property taken near rail trail. Dateline is Fall River. New Bedford residents Ruth and David Glicksman paid taxes on their property on Brayton Avenue for 18 years until the city took a wide swath of their land by eminent domain in 2014 to build the Kekichan River bike path. Now the Glickmans are suing the city, claiming it never paid them for two portions of their land. City attorneys say they never even owned that portion of their property, which Ruth Glicksman says they purchased from the state in 1996. Instead, the city has set aside $40,000 with the treasurer's office in an account for, quote, owners unknown, end quote. The Glicksman's lawsuit alleges the price offered, $20,000 for each portion of land, is too low, and that the Glicksmans are eligible for damages because of the impediment of uses on their property where they once ran a trucking company. During negotiations with the city on the eminent domain action, and after the city claimed Glicksmans didn't own the property that was once under the jurisdiction of Conrail, Ruth Glicksman asked for her 18 years of taxes back. The city's lawyers refused, although Glicksman continues to receive a bill and pay the rainwater tax on the property the city now owns. To add insult to injury, Ruth Glicksman said the city granted an easement to a neighboring developer at the Cloverleaf Mill to build a road that will further impede the use of their remaining land. Ruth Glicksman said they never tried to fight the placement of the bike path, which lies between their property and the Cloverleaf Mill and crosses over Brayton Avenue. However, she said, they should be fairly compensated in an eminent domain action they don't believe was legal. They've been complaining about this taking place since day one, said Corporation Counsel Joseph Macy. Macy is now handling the case, which began before he was appointed in mid-2015. They could have had the money, and they turned it down, he said. Now that the matter is in litigation, any further negotiations on compensation are on hold, Macy said. The lawsuit, filed in June in Bristol County Superior Court, comes after what Ruth Glicksman says were several years of fighting with city attorneys. This has taken years off of both of us. You know, they say, you hit 70, it's supposed to be the best time of your life. I can't even tell you what this has done to our lives, and 2013 is when it started, Ruth Glicksman said. It's just taken our lives away, both mentally and financially. Providence-based attorney Randall Sousa, representing the Glicksmans, said the city is depriving them of the full economic use of their property. The bike path is causing drainage problems on their land, and storm water fees on the parcels taken by eminent domain continue to be levied. Further, Sousa said, the city is violating the law that governs eminent domain regarding the easement it granted to Robert Carrig, the private developer of the Cloverleaf Mill, who had plans to build the road as a second egress from that property. At the same time, the city took the Glicksman's parcels by eminent domain. It took a portion of Carrig's land, but unlike the Glicksman's, Carrig was paid $52,000. The easement agreement gives no monetary compensation to the city, although Carrig is responsible for the cost of constructing the two-lane road. The developer's plan has prompted rail trail advocates who worked for 10 years with the state to build what they call a linear park to fight the easement. You can't do that, taking land for private use, said Sousa. According to the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution, any governmental taking of private property by eminent domain must be for public use, Sousa wrote Macy in a letter dated in September. Sousa said the city's action constitutes, quote, an illegal and invalid taking, end quote, of the Glicksman's property. Mayor Jaciel Correa II, who originally sent down the easement order for city council approval in April, has claimed that no road will be built. But the rail trail advocates, the Glicksmans and their son, Sam Glicksman, are skeptical and believe that building a two-lane road from Carrig's property was part of the planned taking all along. In fact, the proposed road had been rejected by the state as far back as 2013. Sam Glicksman said the bike path is only 10 feet wide, yet the city took a 66-foot wide swath of land. Standing in the rear of a garage that housed David Glicksman's truck and repair shop before he took ill and closed his business, Sam Glicksman showed how a two-lane road would practically abut the building, making it impossible for any vehicle to enter one of three bays that once serviced the fleet. A narrow road to an upper portion of their property would likely be nearly blocked to access their land, he said. This is for trucking. You can't turn any trucks around here. They've disturbed our business. Never mind taking the land without compensation, said Glicksman. Next headline is price hikes push health coverage shoppers into hard choices. Margaret Leatherwood has eight choices for health insurance next year, but no good options. The cheapest individual coverage available in her market would eat up nearly a quarter of the income her husband brings home from the oil fields. The Bryson, Texas couple makes too much to qualify for Affordable Care Act tax credits that help people buy coverage, but they don't make enough to comfortably afford insurance on their own, even though Paul Leatherwood works 7 days a week. I hate to put it like this, but it sucks, said Margaret Leatherwood, who stays at home and takes care of her grandchildren. This largely middle-class crowd of shoppers is struggling to stay insured. They've weathered years of price hikes and shrinking insurance choices with no help. Faced with more price increases for next year, they're mulling options outside insurance or skipping coverage entirely, a decision that could lead to a fine for remaining uninsured and huge bills if an emergency hits. The sign-up period for 2018 coverage closes on Friday in most states, meaning shoppers have only a few more days to find something that squeezes into their budgets. I kind of cringe when I am meeting with those clients because I don't have a solution for them, said Kelly Rector, a Missouri-based insurance agent. The ACA, that is the Affordable Care Act, helped chop the U.S. uninsured population 41% to 28.8 million people earlier this year from 48.6 million in 2010 when it became law, according to the latest government figures. The law expanded Medicaid coverage for the poor and created health insurance marketplaces where people can use income-based tax credits to buy a single or family individual insurance plan if they don't get coverage through work. Those subsidies cover part or all of the bill, capping insurance costs at a percentage of income for those who are eligible. That shields recipients from price hikes of 20% or more that have hit many markets. But that help stops abruptly for people making four times the federal poverty level or more, around $48,000 for an individual and more than $98,000 for a family of four. Of the roughly 15 million people who bought ACA-compliant individual insurance for this year, nearly 7 million had no tax credit help, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. Meanwhile, the uninsured rate among adults who make too much to qualify for help buying coverage jumped to 5% this year from 2% in 2016, according to the Commonwealth Fund. Brokers and healthcare researchers expect that to climb again, especially for people with income levels close to the cutoff for federal help. The vulnerable population includes the self-employed, small business owners, and those close to qualifying for the Medicare program that covers people age 65 and over. These customers can face monthly bills that climb past $2,000 for a family plan, and then a big deductible before most coverage starts. Plus, fewer markets this year have insurance that comes with a health savings account, which lets people save for medical expenses before taxes. Those accounts are popular with individual insurance shoppers who don't get tax credit, said St. Louis broker Emily Bremer. Margaret and Paul Leatherwood wound up with a limited benefits plan this year, but they want better protection in case of a big bill. She is 58 and he just turned 60. They're weighing joining a medical cost-sharing ministry for next year. These ministries are not insurance, but they allow people to band together to share expenses, often by making monthly payments. They can be cheaper than regular coverage, and belonging to one allows customers to escape the Affordable Care Act penalty. Such arrangements usually come with restrictions or qualifications. For instance, participants may not be allowed to use tobacco, and there might be limits on help for medical conditions that existed before the customer signed up. That's really the only option we have that's going to cover anything, Margaret Leatherwood said. Our next headline is Swansea's new Engine 4 blessed and ready for action. The new Engine 4 is a blessing for the Swansea Fire Department that includes nearly 90 volunteers. When the truck, equipped with the most updated equipment and technology, arrived on a Sunday about a week ago at Station 4, 1680 GAR Highway, the Reverend Michael Racine, chaplain for neighboring Fall River's Fire Department, presided over a brief ceremony. He blessed what's termed E4, along with the outstretched helmets of some 30 volunteer firefighters and Chief Eric Hajder, to keep them safe in their daunting, dangerous profession. He said a prayer for us and blessed individually all the helmets, Hajder said. It was much appreciated by the firefighters that were here. Family, friends, and town officials joined them. The $560,000 frontline emergency engine manufactured by Emergency One in Ocala, Florida, and bought at Greenwood Emergency Vehicles in North Attleboro contains a 1,500-gallon-a-minute pumper. The upgrades include two types of firefighting foam, battery-operated electric hydraulic tools to reach greater areas for extrication, lighting at the rear and all around the truck that is far more extensive for safety, and LED-driven to reduce power draws and costs. There are significant upgrades over the one it replaced, Hajder said, of the 1993 E4 that will go into reserve status. That will enable the 1986 reserve engine that lacks an enclosed rear cab for firefighters' jump seats to be taken offline, Hajder said. There's a lot more space, and the design of the truck allows us to carry more equipment, Hajder said. The first 3 hours of training on E4 at Station 4 began Wednesday night. Hopefully, in another week, we'll be able to put it into service, Hajder said. Voters approved the purchased the purchase through taxation at the May 2016 annual town meeting. E4 is the second frontline engine purchased in the past 2 years or so. The headquarters at Station 2 on New Gardens Neck Road has a similarly equipped apparatus. The cost was in the same price range and also purchased through an available taxation, officials said. With similarly equipped new frontline engines, Hodgder said firefighters learning and responding on them would be familiar with the similarly equipped and upgraded vehicle. Typically, 4 firefighters handle each engine. The department has also recruited several new volunteers to undergo 4 months of training from February to late June at the Massachusetts Training Academy. Classes are held in Fall River and Stowe. Swansea, 2 years ago, established a $2,500 stipend for those that complete the training and fulfill a 6-month probationary period. 2 of its volunteer members are women working from Station 2 headquarters. There are 4 stations. Next up, headline: long vacant downtown Fall River building to become doctor's office. Doctors Plus will move its headquarters into a building at the corner of South Main and Columbia Streets this spring. The company, owned by Dr. John Marshall, purchased the vacant storefront at 303 South Main Street. Work is underway now, and the practice hopes to be in its new home by March or April, according to Natalie Rainville, the office manager. We don't have a firm date yet, she said. It depends on construction. Marshall will practice from the address along with Dr. Jennifer James, who is also a chiropractor. The office will also offer physical therapy and massage, Rainville said. The building is best known as the site of the former White Food Market. It has also been used as a clothing store. The building was taken in a tax sale in 2013, and repairs were made to both the interior and the exterior by the new owner. The building has been vacant for years. City tax records show that the building has 7,533 square feet of interior space. It also has a 20-space parking garage beneath the building. That garage is accessible by Pearl Street and will be reserved for use by the practice. A subsidiary company, Columbia Corner Realty Incorporated, purchased the building on October 31st for $606,000, according to real estate transfer records. Columbia Corner Realty lists John Marshall as its manager and resident agent on its state corporation filing. Once the offices are ready, Doctors Plus will close its office on Rhode Island Avenue and move to downtown, Rainville said. Here's a brief article entitled State Targets Impaired Driving in Holiday Push. Dateline is Boston. Massachusetts officials are reminding motorists to stay sober and avoid distractions over the holiday season. The Executive Office of Public Safety has launched the Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over campaign that includes television, radio, and online ads, and is aimed particularly at young male drivers who are statistically most likely to be involved in a fatal alcohol or drug-related crash. Undersecretary for Law Enforcement Jennifer Quealy says the campaign will emphasize the importance of personal responsibility. She notes that the likelihood that retail marijuana stores will open in Massachusetts next year and that pot can further impair driving, especially in combination with alcohol. Just a reminder, folks, this is Frank Callahan reading from today's edition of the Herald News, today being Monday, December 11th, 2017. We'll continue with our reading from the opinion page of today's paper. The first opinion piece is entitled A Tale of Two Cities in Bristol County. This piece is written by Sally Chapman Cameron. It is the best of times. Two municipalities in Bristol County, Fall River and Westport, have amazing best-of-times chances to build brand new schools and pay only a fraction of the costs. Fall River and Westport receive funding from the Massachusetts School Building Authority, a state agency that distributes funds collected through the state sales tax. 1%, I'm sorry, that's 1 cent from everything we buy goes to this fund, and school districts all over the state compete for this funding. Only 10% of the districts applying in any year get accepted, which makes it even more momentous that two districts in our area got the green light. Westport, okay, not a city, and Fall River are on the cusp of receiving a collective investment of more than $150 million to solve problems in their communities. In Westport, they propose a $97 million middle high school, tearing down and remedying its contaminated and closed middle school. They will replace it with a 21st century educational building to house grades 5 through 12, anticipating the issues ahead with the more than 60-year-old high school. The town's cost? About $39 million of that. As the Herald News said in an editorial Thursday, December 7th, urging voters to say yes. But if the proposal is approved, Westport will receive a deal hard to ignore in the form of reimbursement from the Massachusetts School Building Authority. Fall River will replace the problem-plagued Durfee High School with a bright, modern building that will become, in Superintendent Matthew Malone's words, quote, the jewel in the crown of this amazing city, end quote. The city is eligible for up to 80% reimbursement of the projected $260 million building cost. Sharp pencils are still figuring final costs, but this fact is clear. Fall River's cost for a new high school is less than the cost of renovating the current Durfee. The ripple effect of building new schools will benefit more than families with children. A new school invests in the community, bringing jobs in the short term as they build the facilities and pride in the long term. Countless examples around the country demonstrate that investing in new schools increases enrollment, academic achievement, and property values. And even more important, it makes the city of Fall River and the town of Westport more desirable places to live and incubators for economic growth and prosperity. One of the primary qualities companies look at when considering setting up shop is the quality of the schools. The schools educate the people who will work for our businesses and will provide a steady stream of well-educated workers who can find good jobs in our communities. There are many places where you can learn about each project, including DurfeeRising.com and the Westport School Building Committee website at westportsbc.com. The Westport SOS, Save Our Schools, Facebook page, and the Durfee Rising Facebook page are also great resources. Read about the prudent fiscal decisions that have been made and why kicking the can down the road is an expensive and foolish option. Those who live in these communities have some skin in the game to make these projects happen. In late winter, Westport and Fall River, each school project will go before its community to vote to approve the funding. Voting no doesn't mean these projects are off the table. The state agreed that these were two of 90% more that needed doing now. It does mean, however, that some other district gets our money. We go to the back of the line for MSBA funding, maybe sometime in the future. And any further renovation or construction will be totally on the taxpayers of the town. It is the best of times in our region, where other money from the Massachusetts School Building Authority will make possible an educational and community hub that will serve each community for decades to come. This is our chance to grasp these opportunities and leap ahead, because our communities are worth this. Sally Chapman is a member of the Bristol County Chamber of Commerce of Education Committee. Our second opinion piece this morning is headlined, Teacher Prep Programs Are Crucial. One of the most important, yet frequently overlooked and misunderstood, components of public school education is the system of teacher preparation programs. The national network of higher education institutions that select, train, and oversee the membership of the country's new teachers holds in its hands the immense power to shape public education through the quality of its emerging teacher corps. And not nearly enough sunlight shines on how these programs select teaching candidates, choose what skills to convey, and assess their graduates' effectiveness. A new proposed bill called the Promoting Real Opportunity, Success, and Prosperity Through Education Reform Act actually seeks to make things even cloudier. The legislation was recently introduced by Representative Virginia Fox, Republican of North Carolina, Chairwoman of the House Committee on Education and Workforce, and Representative Brett Guthrie, Republican of Kentucky, Chairman of the Higher Education and Workforce Development Subcommittee. The PROSPER Act purports to eliminate burdensome federal regulations that put Washington in the middle of issues that are the responsibility of institutions or states, limit student choice, and stifle innovative practices by institutions, according to the bill's summary. The bill also repeals or streamlines reporting requirements that fail to provide useful information to students, families, and policymakers, and exacerbate rising college costs. In effect, the bill would end current requirement that educator preparation programs submit vital performance data to the federal government. Plus, the United States Department of Education would no longer be required to collect and report this data. But the answer is to improve the existing accountability system for teacher preparation programs, not eliminate it, according to Kate Walsh, president of the nonpartisan watchdog organization, the National Council on Teacher Quality. Are the current attempts at oversight of teacher preparation programs actually improving teacher preparation? No. The accountability efforts in place are absolutely not what they should be, but why is the answer to get rid of them instead of fixing them? Asked Walsh. She told me that throwing out the baby with the bathwater in the case of the current level of oversight is indicative of the current administration's view of all regulations across industries. But Walsh isn't sweating it, because the NCTQ does the job of reporting out to the public how teacher preparation programs are doing by partnering with the states themselves. The 2017 State Teacher Policy Yearbook, which is scheduled to be released December 14th, acknowledges that it's the close relationship that the NCTQ has with individual states which provide the organization data that makes progress on its front possible. This is especially noticeable considering that the news this year isn't that anyone, like, shouted from rooftops. From 2009 to 2015, the NCTQ had found progress in implementation of policies to improve teacher quality. Things like tightening admission requirements to get more qualified candidates into teaching, adequately preparing teachers in high-need subjects like special education, and ensuring teachers are highly qualified in their selected content areas. But progress has slowed. As a whole, for nearly 80% of states, the policy recommendations that the NCTQ has been pushing have either stalled or decreased, including increasing oversight of teacher preparation programs, moving more qualified people of color into the teaching pipeline, and instituting more meaningful teacher evaluation. This was about the same as in 2015 and worse than in 2013, when 60% of states made gains. Frankly, it's easy to be unmoved by such statistics. It's true that this topic is largely the education industry's version of inside ball. But parents pay close attention, and you might start to see why it really matters. Next time a note comes home from school or you get the opportunity to visit your kid's classroom, watch for things like misspellings or even inaccurate or politically biased information posted on bulletin boards. Maybe you'll ask your child for details about what goes on during the day and suspect that not much goes on at school, or that your kid's classroom is out of control. You might even read a local news story reporting that your school is getting dinged on state school report cards for poor performance or for not servicing students with special needs adequately. Only then will you realize how vitally important the sleepy topic of state teacher preparation program quality really is to your family and to your local community. Our third and final opinion piece today is entitled "Trump is a No-Show in the Fight Against Opioid Addiction." This piece is written by Albert R. Hunt. The opioid epidemic should command focused attention even from our policy-averse president. It's America's worst drug crisis, especially severe in the working class and rural communities that supported President Donald Trump. Its solution involves spending money, which supposedly doesn't faze Trump, and tougher actions against drug companies, which he's vowed to take. More than 175 Americans die daily from opioid overdoses, according to a presidential commission, far more than the U.S. Centers of Disease Control attributes to car accidents and gun mishaps. Yet Trump has done nothing but Trump has done nothing but talk since his Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis, led by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, issued a report on November 1 filled with dire language and calls to action. "The time to wait is over," it declared. "The time for talk has passed. Here's the record so far." The White House has yet to ask for any new funding for prevention or law enforcement programs to address the epidemic. To the contrary, Trump has been receptive to proposals by congressional Republicans to slice spending on Medicare and Medicaid, two of the biggest programs for addiction treatment. Trump, tapped Representative Tom Marino, Republican from Pennsylvania, to head the Office of National Drug Control Policy. The nomination was withdrawn after the Washington Post and CBS News revealed that Marino pushed drug industry-friendly legislation, undermining law enforcement efforts to crack down on suspicious imports of prescription painkillers. Kellyanne Conway has been named opioid czar to coordinate federal addiction-fighting activities. She is Trump's political spin person, infamous for rebranding misinformation as, quote, alternative facts, end quote. The Conway appointment stands in contrast to President Barack Obama's designation of Ron Klain 3 years ago to coordinate the global effort to contain an Ebola epidemic. My dumbest column in 2014 questioned the Klain appointment. I was covering a Senate race in North Carolina where the Republican candidate, Tom Tillis, was joined by Senator John McCain, representative of Arizona, in blasting Klain as a partisan political operative. I suggested that Obama should give an assignment to General David Petraeus instead of Klain. 6 months later, Petraeus pleaded guilty to mishandling classified information after he misled federal agents investigating his release of confidential material to his biographer and mistress. Klain, who has been chief of staff to Vice President Joe Biden and Al Gore and a top Justice Department official, did a masterful job cutting through bureaucratic red tape and marshaling support for a multi-billion-dollar plan to successfully combat the spread of Ebola in Africa and beyond. Conway, by contrast, is a pollster and political operative with little experience or knowledge about the levers of government. Congressional Democrats have proposed adding $45 billion over 10 years to fight opioid addiction. Neither the White House nor the Republican congressional leadership has given a substantive response. Trump voters have the most to lose. The state with the highest incidence of opioid overdose deaths is West Virginia, which Trump carried by 43 points in last year's election. Overdose deaths are rising fastest in rural counties, where Trump clobbered Hillary Clinton by the historically huge margin of 26 percentage points. In parading as a populist in the presidential campaign, Trump repeatedly attacked the drug industry, which promoted opioid use even after the human costs emerged. His promises to crack down on Big Pharma disappeared after the election. At this point in our broadcast, we will be reading the obituaries from page 2 of today's paper. The first of our deceased is Barbara Oldred. Barbara Beers Oldred, age 80, of Raynham, passed away on December 6, 2017, at Life Care Center of Raynham after a lengthy illness. She was the beloved wife of Arthur E. Oldred. A funeral service will be held on Thursday, December 14, 2017, at 10 a.m. in the Westville Congregational Church, 415 Winthrop Street in Taunton. A private burial will take place in Massachusetts National Cemetery in Bourne. Visiting hours will be held on Wednesday, December 13th from 4 to 7 p.m. in the Silva Funeral Home, 80 Broadway at St. Mary's Square, Taunton. In lieu of flowers, memorial gifts should be made to the Special Olympics in Barbara's memory. Our next deceased is John F. Dator. John F. Dator, 90, a longtime resident and past selectman of Somerset, passed away peacefully at home, surrounded by his loving family, on Wednesday, December 6th. Mr. Dator's funeral will be held Friday, December 15th at 10 a.m. in the Hathaway Community Home of Four Funerals, 900 Buffington Street, Somerset, Massachusetts, with burial to follow in Oak Grove Cemetery, Fall River. Relatives and friends are invited to attend. Calling hours, Thursday, December 14th, from 4 to 8 p.m. In lieu of flowers, please make donations to the Boys and Girls Club of Fall River. Our next deceased is Olivia Martin. Olivia Olive Ferreira Martin, 94, of Swansea, wife of the late John J. Martin, entered into rest Friday, December 8th, 2017, after a long illness. Her funeral will be held Wednesday at 10 a.m. from the Eau Claire Funeral Home, 690 South Main Street, Fall River, followed by a mass of Christian burial at St. Francis of Assisi Church, 530 Gardner's Neck Road, Swansea, at 11 a.m. Interment will be in St. Patrick's Cemetery, Fall River. Visitation is Wednesday morning prior to the funeral from 9 to 10 a.m. Donations in her memory may be sent to the Alzheimer's Association, 309 Waverly Oaks Road, Waltham. Our next deceased is Patrick R. Varanese. Patrick R. Varanese, 48, of West Warwick and formerly Bristol, died Friday, December 8, 2017, at home in West Warwick. His funeral will be held Wednesday, December 13th, at 8:30 a.m., from the Smith Funeral and Memorial Services, 8 Schoolhouse Road, Warren, followed by a mass of Christian burial at 10 a.m., St. Mary's Church, 330 Wood Street, Bristol, burial in St. Mary's Cemetery, Chestnut Street, Bristol. Relatives and friends are invited to attend. Calling hours are Tuesday from 4 to 7 p.m. Our next deceased is Constance T. Remy, 90, former dance instructor for the Russ Whalen Dance Studio. She died Saturday, November 18th, 2017. Funeral services will be held at Notre Dame Cemetery, 1540 Stratford Road, Fall River, on December 14th, 2017. At 11 a.m. And our next and final deceased for today is Mary Paveo. Mary Dos Anjos Silva Paveo, aged 86 of Fall River for 70 years, passed away on Saturday, December 9th, 2017, with her beloved family by her side. Born in Fernay-Duluth, San Miguel, Azores. She was the daughter of the late Francisco and Maria Silva, and the beloved wife of the late John R. Paveo, Jr. Prior to retiring, Mary worked as a housekeeper at Catholic Memorial Home for 13 years and was a parishioner of St. Michael's Church. She loved to go shopping and to eat out. She was the beloved mother of John R. Paveo of North Dighton. Her funeral will take place from the Manuel Rogers and Sons Funeral Home, 1521 North Main Street, Fall River, on Wednesday at 9 a.m., followed by a mass of Christian burial in St. Michael's Church at 10 a.m., interment in St. Patrick's Cemetery. Calling hours will be on Tuesday from 5 to 8 p.m. Our next item is from the sports page. Headline, Celtics 91, Pistons 81. The Boston Celtics prevented Andre Drummond from scoring in the paint and quieted Reggie Jackson on the perimeter. That helped Boston get revenge from a rare loss in a 91-81 win over the Detroit Pistons on Sunday. When Detroit beat the Celtics last month, Drummond scored 26 points and Jackson had 20. In the rematch, Drummond didn't make a shot until late in the game and finished with just 6 points on 1 of 5 shooting, while Jackson was 0 for 9 with 2 points. "We were locked in," said Boston center Aaron Baines. "Our offense wasn't as crisp as we wanted it to be, but defensively, we had a game plan and we stuck with it. We were trying to pack the paint and make them make plays from the outside. Last time, they really had whatever they wanted inside the paint." The Eastern Conference leading Celtics bounced back from a loss Friday night at San Antonio, extending their feat of losing consecutive games only once this season. "We responded not only to that loss at home to Detroit, but also to the tough Spurs loss," said Boston's Kyrie Irving, who scored 16 points. "We want to continue to build character and identify..." It's build character and identity for our team and be responsive with a quick turnaround. Al Horford had 18 points. Jaylen Brown scored 12. Reserve Marcus Smart also had 12 points, and smooth-shooting rookie Jason Tatum scored 11 for the Celtics. Tatum made a three-pointer late to help hold off a potential comeback by the Pistons, putting Boston ahead by 8 points with a minute 55 seconds left. Boston shut down the Pistons' offense after giving up a season-high 118 points on 52% shooting in the loss to them. On Sunday, the Celtics held Detroit to a season low in points and forced it to miss two-thirds of its shots. Baines kept a hand, arm, or shoulder on Drummond while defending him, keeping him out of the lane as much as possible. "They never took a body off him, and we could never take advantage of it," Detroit coach Stan Van Gundy said. "He got shots for other guys, but we didn't make any of them." The Pistons have lost 6 straight for the first time since late in the 2014-15 season. "We've lost some confidence," Van Gundy said. And our final item in today's papers, also from the sports page, headline is Wright arrested for domestic assault, Boston. Red Sox pitcher Stephen Wright was arrested on Friday night on charges of domestic assault. "We are aware of the incident involving Stephen," said an emailed statement from the Red Sox. "This is certainly a matter that the Red Sox take very seriously. It is our understanding that both local police and MLB are looking into this, and for that reason, the club won't have any further comment at this time. A statement from the Wright family, issued through a lawyer, Alex Little, and obtained by NBC Sports Boston, said the arrest stemmed from a verbal argument involving his wife, Shannon, and that Wright, quote, did not raise his hand at anyone during the incident, end quote, and, quote, the situation was purely emotional, end quote. That's the end of the quote and also the end of our reading of the Fall River for today. I'm at the end of the hour. This has been Frank Callahan reading from the Monday, December 11th, 2017 edition of the Fall River Herald. I'd like to remind you of our telephone number, which is 508-539-2030. Please call us with your comments, suggestions, and questions. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.